This week on Snark Squad Pod, we are joined by Kat O'Keefe to discuss the novel Vicious by V.E. Schwab. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. My name is Nicole Sweeney.
I am Marines, and today we are joined by Kat O'Keefe. Kat, say hi.
Hi, my name is Kat. Thank you guys so much for having me. I have a YouTube channel called Katitastic, where I post occasional videos about books, both what I'm reading and, as an aspiring author, what I'm writing. But I'm not super active on YouTube currently. I do spend a lot of time on Twitter, mostly retweeting memes. So if you're into that, you can follow me there at Kat_Tastic.
We invited Kat today to talk to us about Vicious, the first in what I believe is going to be or stay a duology by V.E. Schwab. And this was chosen for us by our patrons. So thank you to everyone on Patreon for participating in that poll. I nominated Vicious for the poll. So, you know, thanks for having my back, guys. This is the one I wanted. So Vicious follows college roommates Victor and Eli. And we kind of access their story through two timelines. First, we meet them when they're in college and they're beginning to work on their thesis proposals. Eli decides that he's going to do his on extraordinary, so essentially people who have superhuman abilities. And he begins working under the idea that you gain these abilities because of trauma, specifically near-death experiences. And Victor is like, cool, let's try dying. Let's test it out, see what we can do. And they both do the experiment, and their experiment ends in success. So they both end up with abilities. Victor gains the ability to cause and ease pain, and Eli the ability to heal. In the process of all of this, specifically when Victor is gaining his powers, Eli's girlfriend, Angie, dies, and she's literally just there to be like a female bystander. So, you know, yep, check that off. Superhero story, woman dead. And Victor turns to Eli for help in all of this, but Eli turns on him and reports him to the police. They have a bit of a showdown. They fight. Eli shoots Victor, and Victor ends up surviving, but he does get sent to prison. And then the story moves ahead. It's kind of told interwoven, but the second part of the story moves up 10 years, and Victor has broken out of prison with his new BFF, Mitch, and they are trying to track down Eli because Victor wants his revenge. He wants vengeance. It turns out that Eli has been killing EOs for the past 10 years, like on a divine mission to rid the world of the extraordinaries because they're unnatural. Eli is running with a girl named Serena, who is a college student who, through a near-death experience, gained the ability to make people do whatever she wants. And Serena lures her little sister Sydney to the city, basically so Eli can murder her too, because she has the ability to bring people back to life, back from the dead. Sydney escapes, and when they're trying to kill her, she escapes and she's found by Victor, and she joins their little crew. And in the end, Victor forces a confrontation with Eli. First, he kills Serena so that her influence power won't be in play anymore. Victor and Eli fight again, and Eli keeps regenerating because he has kind of like the better showdown power, and he does end up killing Victor. But then the police show up and Serena's not around to use her sway on them, and they end up taking Eli to prison for what they soon discover is serial murders. And then at the very end, Mitch and Sydney go get Victor from his grave and bring him back to life. Good?
Woo! So we are going to start this conversation where we always start it. I think this is a little bit of a given on this one, given for everybody but me in terms of how they're coming to this book. But Kat, did you like this book?
Yeah, I loved this book. I read it for the first time back in, I guess, 2013 when it came out. And it was one of my favorites of the year. I really like Victoria Schwab's writing style and her stories. This reread around, I approached it with more of a critical eye, like trying to identify, like not just reading it as a reader, but kind of trying to analyze it a little bit more. I do think that the pacing isn't perfect. I don't know quite how to articulate it, but it's kind of a slow burn story. And like within the chapters themselves, it's kind of like slower paced and very immersive. But the way the chapters are interwoven, it's kind of hard to get your footing sometimes. And it just feels a little jarring. And it's more like a thriller, choppy pacing, but a slow burn story. Like after reading this, I loved it a lot more having all the pieces than I did when I was in the middle of it and trying to connect all the pieces. Like after it, I see everything big picture and I love it. But when I was in the middle of it, I did feel a little bit lost at times. And like, I wanted to follow certain storylines, but we were shifting to something else. And I mean, it worked in a way because it really propelled me through the story, but it was a little bit hard to like really find my grounding in it sometimes.
I read this in 2015, and so I loved it when I finished reading it as well. So this was a reread for me, and I still found that my feelings were pretty much the same, even though I probably would I'd rate it a little harder this time around than when I first finished reading it. I was just like, yes, amazing, 5 stars. And now I sat down, I was like, okay, this isn't a perfect story. And I think the pacing is probably my biggest complaint out of everything. And part of the reason that I was really anxious to go back and like reread and re-experience this is because it is a story basically about morally gray characters, villains, and just some messed up people, which are like my top three of things that I never want to read about. And so, but I love this book. So it always stayed with me. Like, I want to go back and revisit that to see if it was a fluke or if I really liked it or whatnot. And I think part of the reason that I do enjoy it so much is because there's a lot to talk about here. And so even if you don't, the story is kind of like meh to, you know, you didn't like it or whatever. I feel like there's so much here that you could pick apart just talking about the characters and their complexity. So yeah, I liked it when I first read it and I still really enjoyed it on reread. Mm-hmm.
I just finished reading this book last night and I did not rate it on Goodreads as soon as I finished, which is rare for me to do. Even like usually I will give something a star rating immediately and then I'll like circle back to leave an actual review. And like sometimes while I'm writing their review, I might change the star rating, you know, up or down one or whatever. But I didn't know what to say about it or like how, I don't know. I didn't know how I felt about it when I finished. Mostly because I think this is a good book that was not for me. But I'm excited to have a conversation with you guys about it because I agree that there is a ton to talk about here. I really liked the writing. I think the writing is fantastic. Co-sign on the sort of general points about the pacing that, you know, that was probably where the book is weakest is in the pacing. The time jumping at the beginning really did not work for me. But mostly like the middle section of this book was really just viscerally uncomfortable for me in a way that made it hard for me to even like think about all of the, you know, interesting things that are presented in this story. You know, like I was just so acutely aware of my own discomfort in a way that made it really difficult for me to properly appreciate the story itself. But I think that that is more of a me thing than it is a this story thing. So I don't know. I'm excited to have this conversation. I still don't know how to answer the question of whether or not I liked it. I'm not sure. Like, it's a book that I would definitely recommend to other people. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I will ever read it again. I will probably never read it again. I'm not sure whether I will bother reading the second book. I don't know. I don't know, you guys. I want to, maybe I'll try to answer this question again at the end, see if I'm any closer. But for now, question mark is my answer to this first question.
I mean, I don't want to jump right into like your discomfort, but let's jump into your discomfort because I'm like super curious what about like what parts of the stories really didn't sit well with you, I should say.
So there are two things related, but a little bit different. So the middle section of the book is the point where we jump to Eli. Like that was the first few chapters where Eli becomes the sort of point of view character. That was heavy on the, I don't want to be reading this right now for me. Part of that was, and we just talked about this last week when we were talking about our year in review, but the self-harm stuff, like, I didn't know that that was coming. And it's obviously coming from a, you know, not quite the same place that it usually is, because in the case of Eli, he's doing it to test his powers. But it was still, that didn't make it any less miserable for me personally to read. So that, like, that is a level on which this is, like, profoundly a me thing, slash, you know, anybody who has that as, like, a trigger issue, that is, I don't know, a warning that I'm going to put out there, that that stuff was genuinely, like, really difficult for me. The other thing is just, like, being in his head while he's thinking about how righteous a murderer he is. I understand its function for the story, and so that's why, like, I have a hard time kind of grappling with how to discuss it, because I don't think that it's necessarily, you know, a bad choice for the story, and you know, or that we shouldn't read things that make us uncomfortable sometimes or whatever, but it was just, I don't know, his righteousness about all his murdering was, there was a little more of it than I really wanted to be spending my time with.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. I think both Eli and Victor are, like, it's never stated in the book, but, like, they're sociopaths.
Right. Yes.
You're supposed to be, like, you're not supposed to really relate to them. Like, they are really messed up. So, like, that discomfort is probably kind of intentional. Like, mm-hmm. I think a really interesting question about that this book kind of raises and doesn't give you a straightforward answer is if the EOs, like, come back actually missing something or not, because that's what, uh-huh, like, Eli, and he convinces Serena as well. And I mean, they all kind of feel it in themselves that, like, I came back a little bit wrong, like, I don't feel the same. But how much of that is, like, some part of their soul or, like, some fundamental part of themselves missing, and how much is just that they have changed from the trauma and these new abilities?
I think so. A couple things here. First is that I didn't remember the self-harm portion of it, like, from my first reading to this, but also I would not have thought to frame it that way, because to me, you know, as, you know, in my, I guess, privilege, because I don't really, that's not a trigger for me specifically. It was him testing his powers, but thinking back on it, when he is doing it and almost, like, he's doing it purposefully to kind of, like, cleanse himself at some point. So that is something that I had not thought about, but it is, like, a super visceral, intense moment of the story. So that trigger warning is, like, thank you for putting that out there. I would not have thought to, like, frame it that way at all. So that's super interesting. And I think the other part of it is that that kind of thing of, like, you know, the righteous murderer is not necessarily a story that I often enjoy. But I think why it works for me here is almost because of that, like, intentional discomfort that the author, mm-hmm, never really tries to turn away from. She's never trying to tell us that these bad dudes are good dudes. Mm-hmm. I mean, she takes pains to tell us pretty repeatedly there are no good people in the story. And I, mm-hmm, think that, like, of, like, yes, that's how how I want to consume my villains. I don't like the ones where, like, he's so bad but I love it. Like, I don't want, yeah, that story. Yeah. So I think that discomfort is almost part of the reason that I like this particular story.
Yeah, like, they're complex villains, but they're still all villains.
Right.
It's not like, oh, he's secretly a hero because he saved a puppy. Like, no, they're all bad people.
Now that we're talking through this, I think part of the thing for me is something that comes up for us a lot on this podcast, which is that I should have read this book slower. I think that is ultimately the thing, because I agree with everything you guys are saying. And I think, like, that was part of what I was trying to get at in terms of saying this was just really uncomfortable and unpleasant for me to read, but I couldn't look at it and be like, oh, well, this is, like, a bad choice in the writing, you know, like, this is here's why I think these chapters didn't need to be there or whatever. Like, that was not a feeling that I had even at the time, but I think it was definitely something where it would have been beneficial for me to be able to, like, you know, read one of those Eli's chapters and then just, you know, close the book and walk away from it.
Go watch She-Ra.
Right. Cleanse my soul a little with some She-Ra. Yeah, I don't know. But I think that section, I personally would have benefited from being in a position where I had more control over my reading experience than I did because I was trying to get it done for the podcast.
So I have a question that's more like of a reader interpretation thing, because Kat, you brought this up, but did you think, after all is said and done, do you think that when they come back that they do come back with something missing? Or did we happen to follow a cast of characters who just from the beginning where there was, like Kat said, they're sociopaths. It just is what it is.
It's hard. Like, we meet so few EOs that we actually get to, like, get really close to. Like, the two main ones that we are the closest with, Eli and Victor, they're both sociopaths from the beginning. Like, even before they do this stuff. You know, there's passages about, you know, Eli has the second face that, you know, sometimes slips past his, like, perfect veneer. And Victor, you know, thinks about how he can imitate emotions that he sees other people portraying. Like, if we look at the girls, Serena and Sydney, Sydney definitely feels that Serena is different, but we don't see Sydney feeling a lot that she is different, that she came back wrong. But I don't know. I wonder if just it's the ability that, like, changes them so much, because, like, of course Serena is going to be different now that she has, like, no obstacles in her life. Literally everything she says, someone will do. Like, it's all of a sudden her life becomes, there's no challenge, there's no fun, there's, like, no purpose, because everything is just handed to her. So how much of, like, her change and her belief in, like, the EOs being fundamentally changed is because of that, like, that fundamental change and how it affected her psychologically, or if is she actually missing her soul? I don't know. I don't have any answers.
I come down on the side of no, nothing, like, they haven't come back with something missing. And I think sort of for, like, all the reasons that Kat just kind of laid out, which is that, we, you know, when you look at the four of them, there are some, like, distinct differences, and specifically Sydney. I think Sydney is sort of the case for they didn't come back wrong. They didn't come back with something missing, because Sydney does seem genuinely good. And so that's a component. I think that's really interesting what you were just saying about the abilities themselves being a thing. So in the case of Serena, how that ability would change a person. Whereas with Eli clearly had a strong, you know, sense of entitlement even before, right? And so there's a lot of ways in which the idea that he is now invincible and cannot die, compounded by some other things in his worldview, would just exacerbate everything that was already there. And so, and same with Victor. So I think that there are factors. Maybe this is just, like, sociology major in me, but I am very strong on the, you know, like, there are larger factors at play here that are influencing all of these people. And I don't think that it is the coming back itself that inherently, you know, makes them broken. But I don't know. I haven't read the second book. Maybe in book two, there's better answers.
I feel like I started the souls on Buffy chat. This is the equivalent.
Yeah. Nothing good. Nothing good comes from from that conversation.
Yeah, I'm starting to land more on that side about how it's not that something's missing. It's just that they're different, that it's more like something is added with the powers, because it really does completely change their lives. Like, they don't have consequences the same way that a normal human would anymore. And I think another interesting aspect is the self-preservation side of things, because, like, part of what makes an EO is that they desperately want to live. You know, they have that near-death experience where they die, but they want so badly to come back. And I think that sort of self-preservation is a really interesting quality, because you have examples, like, in the character, I want to say his name is Daniel, the veteran that is the Shadow Walker. Like, he is in constant pain. His life kind of sucks a lot, but he still wants to live and he still has that self-preservation instinct.
I think that that's one of my favorite parts of the world building and just kind of, you know, everything around the powers. I really like that there wasn't a lot of backstory in terms of, like, they explain how you get the powers, but EOs in general are just a thing in this world and it kind of mm-hmm. stands up on its own. I really appreciated that. But I loved how the power matched their, like, near-death experience and, like, yes. those final mm-hmm. moments of what were you thinking, what were you wanting, that, you know, translates over into whatever their power then becomes. I thought that was really neat. It was one of my favorite parts of that.
Mm-hmm. I also, to this question about souls, I like the fact that it's something that the characters are thinking about, but that the book doesn't really answer. I enjoy that. I mean, it's nice also when you're, you know, reading a story with, like, really fleshed out magic systems and you get definitive answers. We've talked about this a little bit with the A Song of Ice and Fire books, you know, like, what is Endgame? Are we ever going to know what's true in terms of the religion of the world? And I like the idea that we are just as uncertain about it as they are.
Mm-hmm. To me, I think the powers is like, it would be the same almost as if they all got suddenly $1 billion. So whatever really sucks about you, like, it's probably going to suck right. more with unlimited mm-hmm. access to money, you know, and whatever's good about you might stay good, but it just kind of changes everything and how you would live your life. I don't think there's anything, like, you know, essentially missing from them because of the near-death experience.
It's more like what's missing is that they just aren't, like, a regular person anymore. They kind of don't necessarily lose their soul, but they lose a little bit of their, like, touch to humanity, kind of, because now they don't have the same consequences. They don't have the same rules that, like, everyone else does, because, you know, like, Sydney can just bring someone back from the dead. Victor can make everyone feel pain or no one feel pain.
Something that we all mentioned back in the beginning that I think is worth getting into is just, like, the pacing of the story. I know that for my part, it, like, was a struggle from the beginning because of the time jumping. And while my discomfort with some of the Eli chapters was something that I could look at and go, I am personally uncomfortable, but I think that this is, like, the correct move, I'm still not entirely sold on the time jumping at the beginning, just because it makes you so acutely aware of the writer. Like, the writer mm-hmm. is so, so present as we're constantly, like, stopping to shift back and forth. And I don't know, it is rare that a story jumps around in time and I am like, yep, that was a great choice.
Yeah, that is the one thing that I don't know exactly how to, like, put my finger on what I would change, but the pacing and the way the chapters were kind of chopped together did feel a little bit off to me. I don't know how to fix it, because after reading the book and, like, reflecting on all the different pieces, like they all make sense together. All the pieces come together and, like, the payoff is there. But when you're first starting it and you're first reading it, you can't really, like, find your grounding in the story because you don't know, like, what place we're going to be next and where we're going. Mm-hmm. And everything is just kind of still, like, setting up and building. It's like a slow burn story, but then the chapter changes just give it, like, a thriller kind of pacing that doesn't mesh super well. I don't know.
I think that for me, like, at the end of it, I really appreciate the format and the time jumps, just because I think that it adds a little bit, like, there's some layering going on in the story. And I really like that, even as you know that Eli and Victor survive, as you're reading about them and these near-death experiences, there's still tension. I'm still, like, oh, freaking out, like, about, you know, how are they going to make it out of this? You know, does he survive? I know he does. So I thought that there was something really neat about how she manages to keep some of the tension in the past, even when you kind of know some of what's coming on in the future. And I like that as we go along, you get to the point where the timelines kind of converge, and then you also start to add, like, point of views. So there was so much layering on it that at the end, I really appreciated that portion of it. I think the issue and how I would potentially fix it if I were Victoria Schwab's editor Oh, man. I think that at the very beginning, the chapters were too short. If you're going to jump around that way, when you're setting up the story, I think you need to spend more time in each of, like, before you jump back and forth. We were doing it so quickly that you couldn't get any purchase in any of the timelines. Like, as soon as you grabbed onto one moment, one character in one timeline, then it would, like, abruptly cut you to the next. So I think we just needed a little bit more space to get our bearings in each of the timelines before she shifted us. And then as you get further along in the story, you can kind of, you know, whiplash us all over the story as much as you want because we're already there. But yeah, I think in the beginning, it just makes it difficult to get into. And I think that that's true. Like the midway point for me on was all a breeze. Like I could finish it pretty quickly. But up into that point, it is choppy.
Is there anything that you would have liked to see more of in the book?
Mitch.
Yeah, that was one thing that also really stood out. Like when the chapters were like cutting back and forth and it was about Mitch, like I wanted to stick with him. I wanted to see, like, we could have gotten his story all at once, I feel like. Mm-hmm. Like his backstory in the prison. Like what Marinas was just saying, like we could have had longer chapters or just like stayed in like each time section a little bit longer, not so much whiplash, especially in the beginning.
I think also I could have read so much more about Serena and Sydney. I really liked them as characters. Mitch too, like all of the surrounding characters, they were all great. And as much as the dynamic of Victor and Eli is good and is the foundation for the story, like even less of them and more of like Serena, Sydney, and Mitch would have been totally okay with me. Especially because overall I'm iffy, and it's one of the things that I wanted to ask you guys about, like the portrayal of the women in the story. And it's a little iffy for me. But I feel like if we maybe would have gotten more of Serena and Sydney, the balance would have been more on the pro side.
Yeah.
So I totally agree with that. And I basically asked the question from the place of our like unofficial segment of writing fanfic, basically fanfic prompts for the stuff that we're consuming. But I, yeah, like 100% the place to start for like fanfic for this is more Serena and Sydney, like just more of their dynamic. And I agree that I think the iffy feeling that you have around their portrayal is directly related to how little time we get to spend with them. And the fact that like Serena, it's not until fairly late in the story that Serena is telling us about herself rather than like being described by other people. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think, yeah, more Serena and Sydney is very much a thing that I would have liked to see.
Yeah, especially because, again, Victor and Eli are sociopaths. It's hard to, like, warm up to them and really connect with them. And then Serena and Sydney, I mean, is Serena a sociopath? She's definitely...
A narcissist, maybe.
Not...
Yeah. I don't like it.
Yeah, because like Sydney is fine, but
Sydney is the truest and purest soul.
Yeah, the only good one. So, like, is Serena evil or is she just, you know, taking advantage of this huge privilege that was kind of dumped into her lap? Because she doesn't seem super happy about it. Like she is excited when Eli kind of like rebels against her power, and she kind of likes to see people trying to rebel against her power, but she also just easily controls them and doesn't seem to feel a lot of remorse about that.
To this point about the Sydney Serena stories that I would like to see more of, I think there is like potentially a really interesting story in this question of how much of Serena's, I don't know, villainy, I guess, is something that was in her already. How much of it is the product of the powers? How much of it is this the soul question? I don't know. In mm-hmm. my head, my like headcanon on this is totally that it was the product of the powers, that like mm-hmm. her powers corrupted her, and you know maybe that she didn't have a strong enough moral center beforehand to like not let it become that way. I'm not sure, whatever. Mm-hmm. But like that's a story that I would be interested in, you know, like I would be interested in that trajectory of like how she goes from being a relatively normal, well-adjusted teenager or college-aged woman, whatever, and like into what she becomes after her powers.
Yeah, that's a really interesting angle about like how much your moral center pre near-death experience would affect you, because like, you know, from what we see, the EOs are all very, you know, about self-preservation. They care a lot about themselves, which, you know, might be a degree of selfishness, or, you know, maybe some of them do want to live for someone else. But the ones that we see, they fight to live like for themselves. Except necessarily Sydney, who, like, when she's dying, she's just like, come back, come back, come back to her sister. But yeah, I wonder how like moral you are before the near-death experience, how much that matters.
I think one of the things that stands out to me too, like in that same vein, is how Eli and Victor both develop. They have to develop kind of their conscious, but they don't really necessarily have one. So Victor talks a lot about how he has to set up like almost his own set of rules and guides to how to act. Like, so even if he's holding a gun to a cop and he doesn't feel guilty about it, still something in him is like, I should feel guilty about this. So he set himself up in order to have these parameters. And then we see Eli has something similar, except for that he has almost like a ritual, and the things that he's going through, like to find the EOs and get rid of them, it becomes very ritualistic for him. And that almost becomes his guideline, his conscious. So I think that idea of like what you have pre-power in terms of like conscious and moral center definitely gets like brought over post-power. And in Serena, we see a little bit of that selfishness and whatnot, with Sydney basically being alone, you know, and her parents are off globetrotting and she's raising herself, I guess. And she calls, Sydney calls her sister and is like, please come home. And Serena's like, nah, gotta go, you know. And you know, not to blame her or say that she's right or wrong, because she's escaping that, you know, aloneness too, but there is a little bit of that selfishness that we then see carried over when she's got all of these powers and nobody can say no to her, basically. Mm-hmm. I mentioned during my recap the other female character that we meet kind of briefly. Angie was her name, right? She was Eli's girlfriend / Victor's love interest. He was like jealous of her. And I keep going back and forth because I think that it was, I can't decide if Victoria did this on purpose and it was like tongue in cheeky, or I don't know. But she's basically a bystander here. She gets killed. And then the best part of it is that Victor has been like, you know, mooning over her and thinking about how jealous he is and she should be mine. And then as soon as she's dead, he's like, wow, I didn't care that much, actually. And Eli is also like, oh, yeah, no, I didn't really care that much either. And then they just move on. And she's like literally never mentioned again. So I want to think that that was almost purposeful and like commentary on it. But I don't know how you guys read that.
I don't remember feeling this way on my first read of the book, but on this reread, I was actually kind of perplexed by how small of a role she had and then how she was just killed off and she didn't really seem to matter that much. Also, I don't know if I just wasn't reading it super close. I have some, like, did Victor go to jail for her murder? Or was it deemed an accident? Like, did he go to jail for her murder? Or was,
I think so.
I think it was her murder.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it was just, she was there to kind of propel their stories. But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed that she didn't have a bigger role and she was just kind of like the woman who gets killed to propel the man's story.
Yeah, it didn't stand out to me too much as I was reading, just because like enough was happening. But that was definitely something that upon finishing the book that was like, okay, well, so that happened. And I don't know whether I think that it was intended as commentary. I don't think that it was effective if it was intended as commentary. Mm-hmm. But I also don't know how how I would change it to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's just that idea of, like, if she's there, if she exists, or usually when you see this woman character who's there to propel the hero story or the villain story, you know, Victor would have broken out of jail and would have been like, for Angie, and Eli would have been like, for Angie. But they literally just look at her and go, hey, nope. Not important. Like, we thought that, you know, this is like the end all be all, like all our feelings for her or whatever. But there's so much more that we're feeling on this other side, which I just thought was pretty interesting. I mean, at the end of the day, you still feed into the trope because she's dead. But it was definitely
she's still, you know, the woman in the refrigerator.
Yes, regardless. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. But there was a little bit of a switch there that I was like, OK, all right. That's the direction we went.
Yeah, I see that. A little bit of a tease of like their rivalry is based around this woman, and then when she's gone, it's like, oh no, their rivalry is just their rivalry. Right. Like, she wasn't actually vital to it.
It's still just a dick measuring contest. So, right.
Yes, I'm not sure whether or not the sort of fridging that turns into nothing was like the most effective thing in the story or whatever, but it is really interesting and like fitting, and I think a good way of demonstrating how like not good these dudes are even from the jump. Mm-hmm. If you see how much they project onto her, like as an object of sort of filling their wholeness. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to better articulate this. I think if you go back to them in their college days, it is this like subtle way of, before they have done anything really truly villainous, like you can kind of already tell that they're just like not very good people. and like an undercurrent of this, one way in which that's clear if you're paying attention, is the way that they are both thinking about the woman who is most present in their lives.
I think she becomes a receptacle of their wanting, basically. They don't know. I mean, it's like almost like the peak of what they could want as two college age students or whatever. And then they get upgraded with these abilities, and all of a sudden they find that their wanting extends so much more. And she's just a casualty of that. You know, she was what she was during that period, but you know, they've got bigger fish to fry, I guess. And they move on. And you really start to see, like, okay, so that's where like that whole argument of, or not argument, but the idea of like, oh, they came back wrong, like she really starts to cement, like, I don't know, they were kind of wrong in the first place.
Right they were both already wrong. But I will say then the other side of this is that while I think she is useful to their characterization, it does circle back to whether or not this was like a useful storytelling device overall, because she as a character starts out really important but ultimately never really gets to exist as anything other than a, as you put it, like receptacle for their wants.
Yeah, I wonder how it would have changed the story if she had more agency, if maybe she found out what they were doing and she wanted to get in on it. She wanted to test it herself, and like maybe that's how she died. Like she was trying to get powers like them, and she died. And like that might have changed the story in a different way, or at least just made it so that she wasn't just like the toy that got broken in their fight.
Yeah, I like that phrasing too. The toy that got broken in their fight. Yes, totally.
Because these are man babies. We've mentioned a little bit about kind of the lack of moral center in the story, and Sydney existing as maybe like the one bright spot of good there. And even with her, Victor makes a comment about how, you know, she's not a child anymore and she's seeing things that are quickly changing her perception or whatnot. But I think that the real bright spot for me, and like the one area of like hope, is the found family that Victor kind of builds up around himself, with Mitch and Sydney. And I would not say that I root for either of these two men at all in the story, but only in so much as, like, I want the little family to stay together. So
right. I want Victor to, like, maybe become a little less terrible,
yeah,
so that Sydney can be happy.
Right.
Like, not for Victor. Like, fuck Victor. Like, also, Victor, I want Sydney to be happy. So
yeah. So you're like a fan of Victor, but only because Sydney likes him.
Right.
Like, it's all for, it all comes back to Sydney. Yes. I think that's, I mean, kind of the point of her character is to soften Victor a little bit, because, like, he is a bad person. Like, none of them are really easy to root for, but then Victor, you know, saves this gunshot 13-year-old and gives her a home
and a puppy.
Makes her feel safe for the first time in a long time. So.
And then Serena tells her, go where you feel safe, and she just goes and finds Victor.
So many feelings.
See, I wonder how, like, if, you know, maybe a lot of the moral ambiguity, like their lack of a moral center, like how much of that just comes from becoming like a jaded adult? Like, Sydney is young. She's 12, 13.
Oh, no. Like, I don't like what you're implying about where Sydney's headed.
Maybe she's just innocent because she is still young and innocent. Like, I mean, Serena was going to let Eli murder her little sister just because she felt like, you know, she came back wrong. They both came back wrong. And, like, she believed him that that was the right thing to do. She could have easily talked him out of it. She could have told him no.
Her whole power.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Oh, man. I mean, I think there's definitely some of that. Just because we see it in her, too, and her, like, blind trust of her sister, and, like, her sister, no matter, even before the power, like, her sister said anything, and she was like, yes, okay. So I think there's some of it that is, like, being young, but I think a part of it is personality. I don't know. I just want to think of her as, like, precious and lovely forever. And I mean, the second book does follow more of her story, I believe, so I'm almost hesitant to go and see if she's been jaded by all of this. I just wanted to picture her and the puppy and, you know, her drinking chocolate milk and having a nice time.
I mean, she does have, like, such a dark power, though.
I know.
And, like, there could be more repercussions that we don't really see because of, like, how cold she is all the time. And, like, when she was saving the dog Doll for the second time, like, I didn't know she could keep just bringing them back endlessly. So, like, that is another question about, like, is that going to affect her? Like, maybe not just, like, having the power, but using it often. Will that affect her?
I want a comic book series where Sydney goes around saving dead pets.
Oh, are you fan fiction corner? That's adorable. With guest appearances by Mitch, who drives her around.
Yes. Basically. Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Have you ever seen the Twitter, like, I pet that dog or something? She just pets people's dog. That, but Sydney.
I revived that dog.
I think that the found family stuff is especially interesting here because everybody has a fucked up family, basically. Like, all of them come from weird homes where the parents are absent or whatnot. And it gets a little, there are a couple of things actually that get a little, like, on the nosy here where it's like, oh, it must have been fate. And I'm like, really? Another word for that's contrivance. But I mean, it's fine. But also the way that all of their parents are literally missing is interesting to me, but I think it's purposeful because she puts such a strong found family here in the middle of the story too.
Yes. I definitely love all of the found family stuff.
Me too.
In addition to liking the found family, I feel like before we end this episode, I have to answer the question that I was supposed to answer at the beginning. I feel like my star rating on this would be like 3.5 stars. I feel like I can't give it anything much higher than that because of the degree to which I personally was uncomfortable with it. But having this conversation is making this book live so much better in my feelings.
Success.
But I can't tell if that's the book or this conversation. Did I like this book or did I like talking to you guys? Unclear.
Go rate me 5 stars on Goodreads. Thanks.
Yes, 5 stars for both of you. And on that note, we are going to end this episode of the podcast. You can give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. That would be very, very lovely. You can also share all of your thoughts about Vicious over on SnarkSquad.com, where there will be a post dedicated to this episode. Or you can join us in our community on Patreon at patreon.com/SnarkSquad, where a poll of patrons chose this book for us to read in the first place. As always, you can also find us on Twitter at @snark_squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name Is Mighty Niz.
And you can find me at @cat_tastic.
Thank you so much to Kat for joining us. And thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the delightful theme music that is playing us out right now. And we will be back in your podcast feeds again next week. Bye.
Bye.